Welcome back to Philosophy Raga, the video game podcast by Chris, the sometimes vaguely philosophical mage. This is the show that is to academia as Stephen Colbert is to journalism. Journalism. I'm leaving that in. That has to stay in. Anyway, the show is a production of The Well Read Mage. Please visit thewellreadmage.com to find out more. Stick around until the end of the show to find out how to support the work we do, because it really couldn't happen without you. Thank you very much. On with the show. Video games occupy a weird space in the public moral consciousness. Every so often we'll get another round of fervour and clickbait as some person with a bit of influence and not too much in the way of fact-checking ability declares that gaming is an enemy of the people, or claims kids are being desensitised, at best, and at worst brainwashed into committing horrific acts of violence by what they're seeing and doing in virtual worlds. I think most of us who enjoy playing games find these suggestions perturbing and probably just plain inaccurate. Still, it does raise a point that I think is worth considering. Let's take Grand Theft Auto, the prototypical franchise about anarchy and illegality. You can do a lot of stuff in the various titles of the GTA franchise that I hope you probably wouldn't do in the real world. Drug deals, dangerous driving, murder, all the classics. But there are no real consequences to you doing this. Right? If you're thinking about the consequences of an action as a way to evaluate what's moral and immoral, like we talked about in the last episode, then your evaluation of any act in a video game is probably going to boil down to something like, it's not real, so there's no pleasure and no suffering on either side. It's morally neutral. It's almost as if there's no act at all, and maybe in utilitarian terms, there isn't. If you read TV tropes at all, you might be familiar with the phrase video game cruelty potential. It does have a cousin, video game caring potential, but that's not as interesting for today's purposes. So video game cruelty potential is a huge, and I mean a really huge, list of bad stuff you can do in games. So just for a couple of examples, in Fallout 2, you can force this con man to dig up buried treasure, and then you can throw a landmine to him and tell him to catch, so he's been digging his own grave. In Hitman Blood Money, you can pour lighter fluid on a barbecue, wait for your target's wife to turn it on and get immolated, and get this, even better, the reason they're doing a barbecue is because it's their youngest kid's birthday. That's savage. Oh, and in Mass Effect, you can casually commit genocide and wipe out an entire species. In that last one, you'll even get warned twice by NPCs that what you're doing is, like, really clearly just a dick move, just to make sure you really want to go through with what is, in the game's terms, an unspeakable atrocity, but to you, the player, in real terms, it's nothing. All of this is actually kind of a tangent, but we'll come back to it, leave it parked there. Leave it parked like a car in GTA, which would immediately get stolen by you. So, returning to GTA, I think it's fair to say that none of the protagonists in the series are utilitarians. It's pretty clear that they inevitably leave suffering behind them and add very little to the pleasure or happiness in the world, other maybe than their own happiness and that of some of their close accomplices. It seems pretty clear that they're not concerned with the consequences of their actions in terms of the damage they're doing to individuals and probably to society as a whole as well. What about virtue ethics? I don't think they're much for that either, although maybe from their perspective they're acting in accordance with virtues that they've, you know, spent a lot of time cultivating. Virtues like streetiness and bad mother effer etude. I mean, I haven't played a GTA game in a long while, so maybe one or more of the player characters do actually have some sort of moral struggle and reconsider their criminess, but for simplicity, I'm just going to continue talking as if all of them get super crimey with no regrets. I'm also just going to say Trevor as a shorthand going forwards. I think Trevor Phillips being one of the characters you can play as in GTA 5, just as an example so that I'm not just talking about all the GTA characters in some sort of weird and abstract way. So if you're not convinced that your own character is what makes moral right or wrong, and the consequences of your actions don't really seem like a viable candidate either, what's left? Well, how about something that's actually in the nature of the actions themselves? We mentioned last time that utilitarianism comes under the brackets of consequentialism, or teleology, meaning something concerned with purpose and outcome. This time we've got another ology to consider, deontology. It may not surprise you to learn that deontology is another Greek word. It means to have to do with obligation or duty. In the context of moral philosophy here, it has to do with acting in accordance with rules. rather than do the utilitarian thing and try to do some sort of calculation to work out what consequences an action's going to have, shouldn't we just have universal rules we can apply? Wouldn't that be easier? The question, of course, is what those rules should be. A guy called Immanuel Kant, or sometimes Kant, but I prefer Kant, I don't know why. Anyway, a guy called Immanuel Kant, who is notorious among philosophy students for being absolutely horrific to read in translation, and even worse to struggle through in his native German, he proposed actually a pretty simple way of working out what the rules should be. See, Kant was kind of disappointed with utilitarianism. Murder is wrong in a utilitarian framework, sure, but it's because it doesn't maximise the goodness or happiness for those involved. But if someone's only concerned with their own pleasure, then that doesn't actually get you very far in convincing them that they're doing the wrong thing. Trevor in GTA 5, for example, is clearly not fussed about whether he's promoting happiness or suffering in the people he deals with. He only really uses those people for his own ends and to get happiness for himself. So Kant starts thinking about motivations, and he came up with the idea of imperatives. Imperatives in Kantian frameworks are basically statements about the actions that you need to do to achieve certain goals or satisfy certain motivations. For example, if I want to satisfy my hunger, I must eat. Or maybe more relevant for Trevor, if I want to make millions of dollars, I need to kill a bunch of cops and steal a bunch of drugs. Or my other half was playing GTA 5 the other day and I think she was stealing a nuke in a submarine and there was a helicopter involved, and it all seemed like way out of whack, and then they couldn't even sell it and it was really disappointing. Sorry, spoilers, but I just wanted you to know that GTA 5 is a really weird game. And you should play it because it looks great. I haven't played it. My other half plays it. She loves it. I haven't played it. She likes it too much. Anyway, those if I want X, I have to do Y sort of statements are what Kant calls hypothetical imperatives. In a hypothetical, if I want this or if I have this motivation situation, they tell you the action that necessarily follows on from that. That's not good enough, though. We need something more universal. We don't just want to know how to achieve the ends that we're feeling like achieving. We need to know which ends should we be trying to achieve in the first place. What we need is a categorical imperative. Something we can apply to everyone and everything all the time. And it has to be something that compels people to follow it too. It can't be something that people just decide that they don't feel like following. This means it has to be something that, if you don't follow it, causes a logical contradiction. Anything short of that is just too arbitrary. So Kant has a think about this, and he comes up with this categorical imperative. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. I wish I could say that like flowed better and was more obvious what it meant in German. It's really not. I'm not going to read it, but no. What he meant by it, though, is something along the lines of only do an action if you could consistently wish that everyone would do the same thing. To illustrate this, let's try applying it to GTA and see how it works. So friendly neighbourhood GTA player character Trevor is about to murder someone. Because he's just learned about Kant's categorical imperative, presumably in like some sort of 18th century German philosophy themed strip act, he considers whether he could wish that murder would be a universal rule. Well, if everyone was murdering everyone all the time, there'd be nobody left to murder. There wouldn't be anyone left to do the murdering either, so I guess that's a no. I mean, Trevor himself would be long dead, he'd probably never have been born. Or in Shadow of the Colossus, which I'm diverting to bring up again because you can't stop me, Wanda can't wish that everyone would murder the 16 Colossi, because then he wouldn't be able to be the one to do it and save his dead girlfriend. Okay, so murder's out, good. But how about lying? If everybody were always lying all the time, there would be no such thing as truth. Nothing would be meaningful, so lying wouldn't even exist anymore, because all truth and falsehood would just be indistinguishable. If you were to wish that lying were to become universal, you'd get to the logical contradiction that lying wouldn't even be possible anymore. A similar thing applies to stealing, just for another example. Trevor can't wish that stealing should be a universal maxim, because then property ownership would become a meaningless concept. If you think about it, if everyone constantly stole everything, nobody could be said to own anything, so the concept of stealing wouldn't even really make sense anymore. So this is what Kant was trying to get at when he came up with the categorical imperative. It's something that's a compelling case for or against an action, independently of how anyone might feel about an action or what the outcomes of it might be. It also gives humans kind of a special place in morality. As thinking and sentient agents who are capable of acting and thinking about these rules, humans are something you can never use as a means to an end. Kant calls humans an end in themselves. Our treatment of others shouldn't be something designed to further our own agendas, but something that advances a bigger set of ends, those of humanity as a whole. Humans are also the only things capable of understanding duty or obligation, and that's the thing that should compel us to actually follow the categorical imperative. Kant really doesn't like stuff being arbitrary. He really wants to build this moral foundation on the strongest, most universal concepts he can. He gets to duty by thinking that a good will is the only thing that can be universally good. He does a bit of gymnastics to get there, but basically, a good will is the only thing that couldn't be used to immoral ends. The intention to do good can't be corrupted if it's pure. Work with me. Anyway, it sounds a little bit virtue ethics-y to say that a good thing is a good will. Maybe, I don't know. But he goes on to say that following your reasoning to work out the dutiful action by using the categorical imperative and then acting on that, even if it goes against your personal inclinations, is the truly righteous thing to do. Duty is absolutely useless if we don't follow it even when we aren't necessarily motivated to or wanting to. Duty is a kind of goodwill which becomes apparent even if there are things making it harder for you to do the right thing. A good-willed person who just always happened to be able to do the right thing easily wouldn't be demonstrating that they were actually someone who does good regardless of circumstances. What use is being good if we don't do it when it's difficult? So, duty is maybe something that should be compelling Trevor not to do crime. Unfortunately, he's probably fairly unlikely to listen to that, but the point is that our deontological theory can at least establish independently that he isn't doing the right thing. Looping back to the beginning a little bit though, should duty also compel us as players not to do bad things in fictional worlds? Well, on the one hand, Kant's conception of duty is based on the worth of humans, and fictional characters most of us would probably think aren't real humans, so we don't owe them anything. Believe it or not though, I actually think I might know what Kant would say about this because of how he felt about animal rights. For Kant, animals don't have the same special status that humans have, so we don't owe them any moral consideration. However, being dutiful isn't something we can just assume we're going to be good at all the time. We need to practice in situations that don't really have any stakes so we can do well when it matters. We have to be responsible and make sure we exercise our self-awareness and our reasoning to do responsible things, to cultivate ourselves into people who are better suited to do our duty in the really important situations. So for Kant, we can kind of use animals as practice. If we treat them well and we treat them kindly, then it should make it easier for us to treat humans kindly as well. It should make us better at doing that because we've had some practice. If we're cruel to animals, though, then although we don't owe them any moral consideration in themselves, it makes us more prone to being cruel to people. We're kind of turning ourselves into a person who has those tendencies. Now, whether all this is actually true, psychologically speaking, is probably up for debate, and whether it's a suggestion that's at all convincing is completely up to you as well. I'm not saying I agree or disagree with any of the ideas here on Philosophiraga, but I hope you'll think about them and form your own opinions. That's kind of the point. Anyway, I think Kant would have a similar feeling towards games as he does about animals. They're an opportunity to practice being dutiful and doing the right thing so that we're better able to fulfill our duty in the real world to real people when the need arises. Interestingly though, Kant is actually almost totally in opposition to virtue theory on this. He doesn't really think it's about cultivating characteristics within yourself as a kind of good thing in its own right. He thinks this is worth doing only in the sense that it gives you an ability to follow duty, even if it goes against your natural character traits. A virtue ethicist, meanwhile, would say one who has the trait of following duty is a good person, or whatever, but Kant would only think it's a good thing if it helps you to do the right thing in the situation. In Skyrim, Parthenax, who you might remember as the big old dragon voiced by Mario, asks, "What's better, to be born good, or to overcome an evil nature through great effort?" Aristotle, our favourite virtue ethicist, would think that being good is the good thing to do, while Kant would say someone who follows duty, even if they want to murder people, is actually kind of more moral than the person who doesn't want to do the murdering in the first place. So that's a thing. Returning to Undertale for a second, we used it as an example in the very first episode, I know, but it's just such a rich source of discussion on morality and stuff that I'm going back to it. I think that Undertale definitely wants you to think of yourself, the player, as having some sort of moral duty to the characters. If you manage to get the very best ending, the one where you didn't kill anyone, the game will quite happily make you feel terrible if you decide to do another playthrough and get all murder happy in it. Why did you reset? Why did you start again and kill people? Why not just leave everyone alive in the happiness that you earn for them by finishing the pacifist run? You've just undone all of that. And as for Trevor, if he understands reason and whatnot, then can't reckon he certainly ought to stop murdering and stealing and lying and all those other quintessentially GTA activities. He probably won't stop, but that just means he's a bad person. Of course, as with all the ideas we've looked at so far, deontology has strengths and criticisms. It sounds kind of appealing having clear-cut rules to apply to actions so we don't have to do any mental calculations before deciding the right thing to do, but there is a question of how specific the categorical imperative is supposed to be. Maybe Trevor can't wish everyone kill everyone all the time because it leads to that logical contradiction, but maybe he can wish that, I don't know, everyone who is a Los Santos street gang member and can drive cars really fast should kill people who dissed them, or something like that. And maybe you think that the fact that deontology doesn't account at all for the consequences of actions is a failing on its part. If you thought in the last episode that you should kill the one to save the five, then maybe the thought that killing is something you should never do under any circumstances doesn't appeal to you. Then again, arguably, you have just as much of a duty not to let five die as you do not to kill one, right? So there are still some grey areas, despite Kant's attempts to make everything universal. As ever, I hope you found this interesting, and now that we've looked at three different ethical frameworks, the question I want to leave you with is this. What's the best way to decide right or wrong? Your character and intentions? The consequences of your actions? Universal rules? Or something else entirely? You can think about all this and more at thewellreadmage.com, on Twitter, where I am at overthinkery1, or on reddit.com/r/thewellreaditpage. Catch you next time, NPCs. Oh, and by the way, this is the last episode to be pre-recorded, so I'm recording this way before the release date of November 23rd, but it's going to come out along with three other episodes on that day. This has meant that I've not been able to ask questions and then actually talk about some of the responses on the show. But the nice thing going forwards is that, hopefully people will actually have answered the questions. So the next time you hear me, it will be about a month from now. And in the intervening period, if anyone's raised some interesting discussions, I'll actually be able to talk about them on the show, which is awesome. So yeah, look forward to that. I am. It'll be great. Talk to me. I love it. Thank you very much, as always, for joining me for this episode of Philosophy Raga, which is written, edited, and produced by me, Chris Durston, with a slight sore throat now. I don't know if you can hear that, so apologies. And I've had some invaluable help from consulting producer Moses Norton, aka The Well-Read Mage. All the music you hear during the show is by me, and the show's logo is by Moses Norton, with graphic design from By Wisdom Designs. The show is part of the MageCast family, so if you enjoy listening to in-depth discussion about games, then my fellow podcasts MageCast and SideQuests are, like, definitely up your street, so go listen to every episode right now. I'm not kidding, do it. The Well-Read Mage's dream of a better future for gaming discussion and community is made possible by your support, so please do give Philosophy Raga a like, follow, review, or share. If you review an episode in the next week, you can win free stuff! Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your donkey, and if you consider supporting us with a monthly pledge of any amount at patreon.com/thewellreadmage, I will personally start a playthrough of a Pokemon game, nickname my starter after you, and ensure that its power becomes famous throughout all the lands. This particular flame might be turning to embers for now, but the fire of wisdom never dies.